Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Randall Strauss, who discusses his new book, Planet Google, one company's audacious plan to organize everything we know, published by Free Press. In the weeks to come, we have Liz Robbins, Gene Guerin, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a moment. It's time to begin.
So first of all, I'd like to say thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore this evening and supporting your local and independent businesses. I'm pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author Randall Strauss. And I had this whole great introduction, and I almost feel like I need to throw it out the window because I had no idea that he grew up right here and went to East High. So I'm going to share with you my introduction, but it's going to be a little bit different than what you may expect. I was going to say, you may know Randall best from his New York Times column, Digital Domain, or you may know him best for growing up in Denver. Or perhaps you may know him from one of his other books, most recently, out in paperback, which we have here as well, Wizard of Menlo Park. Or you may know him from growing up in Denver. And in his spare time, Randall also teaches at the San Jose State University. Or you may know him from growing up here in Denver. But tonight, Randall is here to take us deep into one of the most powerful companies in the United States with his newest book, Planet Google, one company's audacious plan to organize everything we know. So if you would please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Randall Strauss.
Thank you, Beth. This is not the first time I've given a short talk about the book, but this is the most special talk I have given or will give. This is my other home, and it gives me great pleasure to be standing here in the Tattered Cover, and as it happens now, just a stone's throw away from East High. So this is a lot of fun for me, and thank you all for coming. I thought I'd use the time we have to chat a little about the process of writing the book. Instead of giving you a synopsis, why not try to offer you something that you can't get from the dust jacket? I have been writing about tech and tech companies for quite a while, and living where I do and Google doing what it does, I had written a few pieces about Google. Some of them were positive. I talked about their eagerness in collecting PhDs that I saw as one way they set themselves apart from other companies, other high-tech companies. I also praised them for their embracing plain text ads at a time when the web was becoming very busy visually and sonically with ads that were attempting to grab hold of your attention. And along comes Google, which says, we're going to lower the volume and simply, efficiently, beautifully, with plain text, communicate an advertiser that is available, that has wares that are relevant to whatever it is you're searching for. That at that time was a breath of fresh air. But not all of my columns were positive. I also wrote about how Google's CEO, Eric Schmidt, had become quite upset when an intrepid reporter for a online news agency, CNET, had set for herself a task. She gave herself 30 minutes to find out everything she could about Google's CEO, and she would only use Google. And the exercise was meant to find out just how much stuff about us as individuals is out there. And what turns out, she could find out a lot, including his political donations, his hobbies, where he lived. That has to do with the Federal Election Commission's requirement that one disclose one's home. So she described how much she could find out about Google CEO, and when he saw this, he threw a tantrum and announced that Google would not have any contact with that news organization for 1 year. When I saw this, I saw the makings of a fun column. And when, several years later, I had decided to write a book about Google and had finally arranged to have my first meeting with Eric Schmidt, he remembered that column. He brought it up. Fortunately, he didn't hold it against me and did give his blessing to the project, which was to interview lots of people at Google to try to move the story from the familiar early one that we all know. We know it was founded by the two guys at Stanford. We know the brand so well. We use it frequently in the course of daily life. We knew that they had this very successful initial public offering, 2004, that had made billionaires of the earliest founders. That much was familiar. What was not well known, and it forms the subject of the book, is how much Google has grown from that early stage, where it has embarked upon multiple initiatives to fulfill what was its original promise, to organize the world's information. And by all the world's information, it has no modifier, no qualification, no limitation. They really do mean all. And they built the means, in terms of hardware and software, that allow them to actually make a good run at fulfilling that promise of organizing the world's information. So the book is a story of how they went about building that computer hardware, how they went about figuring out how to create algorithms that remove the human element and allow software to do the hard labor of organizing, synthesizing, analyzing, and then serving back to us the information we seek. And in the course of carrying out what was originally conceived of as a kind of academic project, in a way, this is the ultimate form of library science, which on the face of it would seem to be not only just innocuous, but a praiseworthy project. The fulfillment of any educated person's dream of having at one's fingertips, literally, the world's information. It turns out to be more complicated. It turns out that this seemingly wonderful project has some disturbing aspects, and the book is an attempt to start to explore the complications that turn out to be revealed when Google does a good job at exactly what it promises to do, to organize the world's information. So when they start to organize the information that is frozen in the form of pages in printed books that have not been digitized, and it embarked upon its book scanning project, it turns out, as you all know, to be a legally fraught process. When they began to organize geographic information, contracting with satellite agencies to deliver satellite images of what's going to become Google Earth, and actually a project started by a small startup unrelated to Google that Google then bought, that was another kind of way of organizing world's information, thinking about information in a geographic sense. Again, seemingly praiseworthy, beyond controversy, but early on they discovered that when they offered this new service to the world, there were complications. And I tell the story of how one of the first problems was, and this was when they had not introduced Street View, and the only visual component was from high above, the satellite view. It turns out, depending on the resolution, and depending what time we're talking about, distinguishable details could be discerned from satellite view. When they originally conceived of it, they said there were concerns about people being spied upon. And the Google response was, don't worry about it. These are images that were taken months ago, and the resolution isn't that good anyhow. You'll never be able to see something like a license plate or a face. But within a year, the technology, the imaging technology, had improved so much that you could not see license plates. The angle wasn't right. But you could start to see human forms, including sunbathers on roofs. You couldn't distinguish who they were, but that wasn't supposed to be possible. And the technology continued to improve. And it turns out they could rely on not just satellites, but upon low-flying airplanes. So aerial imagery was used to supplement the satellite imagery. So these are photos taken at a much lower altitude over cities with excellent resolution and great detail. And then when they introduced Street View with the vans with the cameras mounted on top that went up and down streets to collect the street level images, then they found themselves facing a great deal of protest. Some of it with, I believe, less merit than others. There was the woman who complained about Google's capturing the image of her cat in her front window, believing that was an invasion of her privacy. What Google discovered was our view of privacy was not what the law would define as private space, but rather custom. It's the privacy we enjoy in public space that is created simply because there's no one else that we know that sees what we're doing. And when Google argued, our cameras see nothing other than what you would see if you were standing on the street, missed the point, which is we have a feeling of privacy when we move about simply because no one else knows we're on the street at that point. And what the Street View service posed was this question of how much of our public space do we want to be able to access? How well do we want to organize our geographic information? And Eric Schmidt himself realized that in the course of offering all of us excellent access to private information, and one of the things that CNET reporter said she could find, of course, was Eric Schmidt's house, and she could put it on a Google map. So you could get driving directions to his house. And one of the interesting aspects of this grand experiment is that it excludes no one. It is egalitarian in nature. So not only does Google organize information about you and about me, but also about Eric Schmidt. It organizes information about everyone. And it forces us to begin to weigh the advantages and the benefits with some of the drawbacks. We also see this in another story that I tell about the addition of video clips, which Google initially tried to organize by taping television broadcasts. The original form of Google's video project was to index closed captioned text, the closed captioning. And you can see why that was the first thing they thought of. The way they'd organize web pages was by analyzing text. Television broadcasts had text, so they would record the broadcast, index the text. They had no way of showing the show that the search came up with, but you could look up when a given word was said on a given program based on the closed captioning. Not a very useful service. Meanwhile, a little startup called YouTube didn't worry about closed captioning. And, of course, it's going to grow and create an entirely new category, the user-generated clip, part of user-generated content. And Google was very slow to recognize this phenomenon, that people wanted to grab clips and throw them up. And it had nothing to do with the kind of sedate, somewhat academic organizing of knowledge that its previous initiatives had been organized around. It was a kind of anarchic, ultra-democratic, and in terms of copyright, pretty lawless expropriation of video. And once Google decided that it wanted to be master of all domains, it put its objections, and of course they realized it was legally an area that would cause some difficulties, the way many clips of comedy, The Daily Show and other nationally broadcast shows that clips were taken without the permission of the copyright holders. When Google bought YouTube in late 2006, they also bought a passel of legal problems. But that was not a deterrent. They were bent on organizing the world's information, whatever domain it was, and they would figure out how to get around any legal difficulties later, and B, they'd figure out how to make the thing pay later. So what's happened so far? The lawsuit with Viacom still stands, despite the settlement of the two suits involving book publishers and authors. There still is this outstanding suit involving Google and Viacom over YouTube's use of unauthorized video clips. They also have yet to figure out how to make money from YouTube, and I think this isn't widely appreciated. As popular as YouTube is, and by the way, from the time Google bought the company to now, it has grown exponentially, and it was already the dominant video site. So traffic hasn't been a problem. But how to convert that traffic into revenue has eluded the very smart people at Google. It's an ongoing experiment. Because those plain text ads have been so lucrative, because those ads are so highly valued by advertisers, Google has been able to make ample profits that, in essence, subsidize the experiments. They've only really discovered one predictable, reliable way of making money, and that is the text ads that accompany search and the text ads that it serves up on partner sites based on the content, the words on the web pages of other sites. Everything else has either not been a success or is, at best, an experiment still in progress, like YouTube. Until the worsening economic situation arrived, it appeared that Google would have an indefinite amount of time to run its various experiments. And whenever anyone raised the specter of Google joining everyone else and suffering from a recession, Google's response was, there will always be a flight to quality, and our ads are the best form of advertising that advertisers can use. For one thing, they're measurable. The results are measurable. Unlike an ad that a commercial that's broadcast, and you don't know what its effect is. With Google's text ads, the advertiser only pays if someone actually clicks on the ad. Google does not collect money for their merely displaying the text ads. It only collects if you click on the ad. And that's, as you can imagine, enormously appealing to advertisers. They're only paying for people who have shown, by that click, their willingness to pursue the information in the text ad. Right now, Google is perhaps going to face the first challenge, the first serious challenge to this grand experiment. Because until now, it has had the means to expand indefinitely, to try out all manner of new forms of organizing information, to hire the brightest grads from computer science programs around the country to lavish, as everyone knows, very generous benefits upon everyone. And to famously promise in 2004, as Larry Page, the co-founder, said in a statement to prospective shareholders, we will add to the benefits that we already provide. That was his vow to employees. Whether they'll be able to be exempt from the economic slowdown, whether they're going to suffer advertising slowdown and have to cut back on the grand experiment is the question that we'll need a few months to see an answer to. Many people have asked me, what do the Googlers think of my book? And I don't know the answer to that. I did have a chance to give a talk at Google a few weeks ago. And right before the talk, I ran into Eric Schmidt. And shook hands, traded some pleasantries. He asked how the book was doing. The book had been out probably a couple weeks at that point. And I said, it's doing okay, but, you know, the financial crisis is very much in the news now. And he commiserated. He said, asked in sympathy about how that would hurt my earnings as an author. And I then gave him a short tutorial on the wonderful practice of author advances that protect me from the immediate effects of disappointing sales. He had his chance then. One of his assistants had told me that he had been given a copy of the book. And he had his chance then to say, love the book, and he didn't say it. Didn't say anything about the book. So my guess is he has, at best, a mixed opinion. I do say some critical things about him in particular. And I have some nice things to say about Google, and I have some questions that I raise about what Google is doing and how it doesn't realize the power that it has gathered. And at my talk at Google, I basically lectured them on the need to become a different company. How I phrased it was, I said, you need to become radically transparent. Because right now, our data goes into your black box, and we don't know what happens to it, really, after you gather it. And what you need to do, if you're going to avoid the kinds of scrutiny that, you know, the Department of Justice had had begun and led to now the announcement that Google was abandoning a deal with Yahoo for an ad deal. There's going to be more antitrust scrutiny. There's going to be more concern by privacy advocates about the power that Google is gathering in the course of organizing the world's information. The only way to blunt that reaction is to give the world ample reason to feel comfortable that what it knows about us is being taken care of properly, that they are the best stewards, that they are willing to let outsiders see how they handle and safeguard our data. The problem of data leaks is one that everyone is concerned about. There seems to be a law of physics that says put a lot of data in a container, it will spring a leak. What does Google do to make sure that our data doesn't spring a leak, to make sure that a board employee doesn't fill his break time by reading my email, which has happened at other companies? These are concerns that until now it hasn't been willing to fully face. I think the recent scrutiny from the Department of Justice was a kind of rude awakening for the company, that it will have to be more sensitive to outside concerns than it has been until now. So I'll leave you with one little note about Eric Schmidt, my little conversation with him that day. Maybe, I'm just I'm making all about me, 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 me. He might have had other things on his mind. At the end of that day, which happened to be a bad day for Google stock, I did a calculation. And on paper, Mr. Schmidt had lost $600 million that day. So I haven't been in that position myself, but I can guess that would have been a tough day. All right. But why don't we close the formal portion. Thank you all for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Liz Robbins, Gene Guerin, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 6th, 2008.